simple lesson. It's a group of stories. If you got an outline or if you took notice in last week's bulletin, the sermon is simply called The Women. And you might have gathered from Kevin's reading, or certainly if you're looking at an outline, we're talking about the women who are involved in the birth of Jesus. This is something that has fascinated me, and I'll get to that in just a moment, but something that fascinates me is the mention of the women and the women who are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But if you will begin with me in Genesis chapter 3, it was clear from the beginning of the Bible that God intended to emphasize the woman of all things in the birth of Jesus when he would come to earth. You'll notice when Adam and Eve sinned and the curses are pronounced upon them, that as the Lord is addressing the serpent in verse 14, he said to the serpent, "Because you've done this, you're cursed above all animals or cattle," the King James says, "above every living creature of the field. Upon your belly you go and you eat dust all the days of your life." But then verse 15, "I will put enmity," that is a clear division, animosity even, "between you and the woman," notice this, "and between your seed and her seed." It is clear from the New Testament that the seed of Satan is those who do his bidding, those who follow him as even his children. But it is also clear that what he's saying here is that there's a direct enmity or division between the woman and Satan, or the serpent here. But you'll notice he goes on to say, "between your seed and her seed, it," that is the seed of Satan, "will bruise thy head," or rather it, the seed of woman, if I can get that clear, "will bruise the head of Satan, and you will bruise his heel." Woman is emphasized from the very beginning, and we know when we come to the New Testament, if you turn over to Galatians 4 and look at verse 4, Paul made it clear that in fact, and he's talked about throughout chapter 3, the seed, as it carries on through Abraham, etc. But then he makes it clear in chapter 4 that in due time, when the time was right, that Jesus came forth to be that Savior. And then he uses this phrase, if you look at the very end of verse 4, "made of a woman," or "born of a woman," and "born" or "made of the law." His beginning, and that's what it literally is saying in the original, his beginning was the law of Moses, announced right here. His beginning was a woman. Now, why am I overemphasizing that? Because it's interesting. When you look, go with me to Matthew chapter 1. And let's make something clear. When we're looking at the genealogies of Jesus, we look at Matthew, we look at Luke, for example, for the literal genealogy, that is by blood, as we would calculate it. By blood, Jesus is descended, of course, through Abraham, of course, through David, but the line is a little different from that in Matthew 1. And the reason why is because the bloodline is in Luke 3, but the legal line to the Jew is in Matthew 1. Why even bring that up? Because the Jews really only considered male progenitors. In other words, if you were to go and look up the genealogy, and you could have in the days of Jesus, you could have gone to the temple and the scribes could have traced your genealogy literally all the way back to Abraham. It was very important. It had a lot of legal precedence to know who you came through, your family tree. It had to do with property. It had to do with rights, for example, of being this or being that. The tribe was important, etc., etc. Now, all that was lost when the Romans destroyed that in AD 70. Again, why am I overemphasizing this? Because women weren't included. When you look at the genealogies, women just don't figure in the genealogies. And when you look at Matthew 1, this is the legal right, the legal line to be king. And women certainly don't figure in that. And yet women figure in Matthew's genealogy. But it gets even stranger. That's why I say I've been fascinated with this. And if I were going to put this on a list of questions I'd ask after this life is over, this might be one of them. Why these women? Because if you'll read with me from Matthew 1, verse 1, there are only five women of all that could have been mentioned throughout history. Some of we even know. But there's only five mentioned. Read this with me. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac. No Sarah mentioned there, but we know. Isaac begat Jacob. No Elizabeth mentioned there, but we know that. So notice how women are being left out that we even know. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judah. King James says Judas, but Judah and his brethren. Judah begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar. Phares begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram, Amminadab. Amminadab, Nashon. Nashon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz, notice, of Rahab. Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. And Obed begat Jesse. Jesse, of course, the father of David. Jesse begat David, the king. And David, the king, begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah, Bathsheba. Now, we have four women mentioned there, and if we added later in the passage that was read a few moments ago, we have Mary. You have five women mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus, and as far as the Jews are concerned, none of them stellar characters. None of them, if you were going to emphasize women, you'd want to emphasize the best, would be the idea, the most prominent, the ones that were really looked up to by the Jews. For example, a Sarah. Notice how Peter, you know, emphasizes Sarah and whose daughters you, even Christians, are, and that kind of thing. Or Paul does that in Galatians 4, emphasizing Sarah, but no Sarah. And yet the women that are mentioned would be women that if you were a Jew and you were trying to honor the genealogy of Jesus and really talk about, you know, who Jesus descended through and so forth, these, for the most part, would be five women you'd leave out. Everybody would know it. But you wouldn't talk about it and you wouldn't emphasize it. So I find that interesting. And I'm just talking from the Jewish mind. I want you to understand that. The Jewish mind, as far as we know, the records we have, and we have a lot of things, you know, from Jewish scholars and rabbis and so forth that go way back before this time. So you can get a fair idea or understanding if you want to labor through, for example, the Talmud. You can really get a Jewish mindset about all of this. And these women... So who are they? Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba and Mary. Who are these five women? Well, you know them. But I want you to go back with me and let's just scan through the stories. Let's start in Genesis 38. Because Judah, that is, you might say, if we're looking at from Abraham on, the fourth generation. Here is Judah. Judah and his brothers, you know, that were begotten here. But in Genesis 38... it tells us the story of Judah, and it is interesting in itself because if you'll take notice, turn back a chapter, from chapter 37 on is pretty much the story of Joseph and all of that ordeal and how it came to be that Joseph saved the people and all that kind of thing. But stuck in there immediately and interestingly, there is this story in Genesis 38. So what is the story of Judah? Well, start with me, and I'm not going to read the whole chapter. We'll scan down through it, but let's get the first part of it. It came to pass at that time, and it's just a general phrase. It means sometime during the time that Joseph is sold into slavery, and it can be, you know, literally several years later, but sometime around that time. It came to pass that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite, and that wouldn't be a name, that'd be an area of the Canaan, of the Canaanites, but into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in unto her. Incidentally, for those of you, and several have been talking to me about so-called contradictions that people bring up, this is one people bring up, so I'm going to mention it in passing and leave it. But notice verse 2 is rather ambiguous. You read verse 2, you don't know if Shua is the father or Shua is the wife. Go down to verse 12 and you can see where this can be considered a contradiction. In process of time, the daughter of Shua It almost reads like in verse 2, Shua is the wife, and it almost reads like it's contradicting verse 12. But again, if you're looking at the grammar in verse 2, it can be either one, and it is obvious that Shua is the father. But Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went unto her, and she conceived. And this is what's important in the story. She had three sons. Er in verse 3, Onan in verse 4, and again Shelah in verse 5. And she conceives these three. And notice in verse 6, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, Er. And there are arranged marriages at this time. We understand it. But he took a wife for his firstborn, Er, and her name was Tamar. And there's our woman. So we're looking at that. We're saying, okay, Tamar. Tamar, basically would be the fifth generation. Well, no. And we realize what's going on here. Er, Judah's firstborn, verse 7, was wicked, and God killed him. Judah said to Onan, go in to your brother's wife. Here's the law of levirate marriage. When we studied Ruth a few years ago, we brought up this whole practice of levirate marriage. A dead brother who is going to inherit and carry on the name of the family and the land and all of that. The law of levirate marriage, if he dies before they have children, then the brother takes her but raises children in his name, not the second brother's name. So notice this. Verse 8, Judah said to Onan, go in unto your brother's wife, marry her, raise up seed to your brother, or descendants to your brother. Onan knew that the descendants or the seed would not be his, verse 9, so when it came to pass that he went in unto Tamar, he spilled it on the ground. He refused to let her conceive and raise descendants to his brother. And God is not happy about this, verse 10, so he killed him too. So two out of the three sons are dead. And then verse 11, Judah says to Tamar, and one would imagine if this is a wife about the age of the oldest son, then the third son might be still a little too young, And the law of levirate marriage would say, wait until the guy is old enough, even though he'd be marrying an older woman, wait until he's old enough. And so Judah says to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, he remain a widow until Shelah, my son, be grown. And he said, lest peradventure this, he would die also, as his brothers did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So if you imagine the story, two of the brothers are dead. There's a younger son here, apparently not full grown. Tamar is taken into the house and, waiting on that son to be old enough, and then she will marry him. Now, it just picks up the story there, and let's scan down through verse 12. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. Now Judah, of course, is without a wife, without a mate. And in the course of time, as I understand what's being said here, his friend that, remember the Adullamite and all of that back at the beginning of the chapter, the two of them go to this area to shear their, I would assume, huge flocks of sheep. In the area of Timnah, they go there, and while they are there, what happens is Judah decides to visit a prostitute. Now again, we're talking about the lineage of Christ, but these aren't perfect people by any stretch. And so he decides he's going in to a prostitute. Well, Tamar gets the idea that what she'll do is, and if you notice, what happens in this story, and you see it here, because Judah has not kept his word. He's not given Shelah to marry Tamar. For whatever reason, later in the story, he will admit that. He will say she has been, if you look down at verse 26, she's been more righteous than me. Even after she plays the prostitute and tricks him, she's more righteous than me because I didn't give her to Shelah, my son. And so, he's not fulfilling his obligation here, fulfilling his promise to Tamar, and or she is impatient about the whole thing, and or she chooses to kind of arrange things and make it happen rather than going to her father-in-law Judah and saying, Judah, you promised Shelah and you haven't delivered. You need to keep your word. You made a promise, you made a vow to God, and you know it's the law of God. You need to keep it. She doesn't do that. She decides to trick him, and she does. She dresses like a prostitute, if you notice, in verse 14. She put off her widow's garments and she puts on the array of a prostitute. She sits openly at the gate, is what I think it's saying. It says in the King James, an open place, but the language can be translated literally, sitting at the gate of the city. But she sits in a public place, and Judah comes along and sees her in verses 15 and 16, and he decides to visit a prostitute. We all understand what that means. And she basically says, well, what are you going to pay me? And he said he will give her a kid of the flock. And so she said, well, I want some kind of pledge. I want some kind of guarantee. And so if you'll notice that, down in verse 18, she took his signet, which may very well be a signet ring. She took his bracelet. She took his personal staff. And to a shepherd, that's a significant item, sometimes even ornamental. But she took those three things, and he went into her, and she conceived a child. Now, he sends his friend to pay off the amount and get basically the IOU, you know, and get the stuff back. And the friend goes, and she's nowhere to be found. She's kind of skipped out from where she was. So he starts asking around, and he says, where's the harlot that was sitting out here, you know, by the gate or whatever? And they say, man, there's no harlot out here. No harlot that stays out here. So he goes back to Judah, and he says, basically to Judah, I don't know what's going on, but she skipped out with your stuff, and, you know, she can't be found. And besides that, the guy said, there is no harlot out there. Now, if you were Judah, you ought to start thinking something weird's going on here. But he just basically says, well, fine, let her come and get it. You know, puts the burden on her. And in the course of time, and I think it's about 3 months that passes here, in the course of time, she makes it known, or it is made known, let me just be exact about it, is made known to Judah that his daughter-in-law, who is supposed to be a widow in mourning, in waiting, is with child. Judah, being like a typical human being, just immediately jumps in his self-righteousness and says, let her be burned to death. And then she comes to him basically with the personal items, the signet, maybe signet ring, bracelet, staff, and says, let the guy come forth that gave me these. And Judah's like, uh-oh. You know. And from that time on, if you'll notice, he acknowledged she was right. He acknowledges it is her child. He doesn't marry her. He doesn't go into her anymore. But he does acknowledge it. That's the story of Tamar. If you're going to choose a person to start off, a woman to start off the genealogy, you skip Sarah, you skip Elizabeth, you skip Leah, and you come to Tamar. A man that has a child by his daughter-in-law when she's tricked him, and he's been less than righteous by far. And they start with Tamar. And there's another interesting twist. Notice that Matthew 1 mentions she bore twins. In verse 27, it came to pass, and it's almost as if God is saying, let's just talk about all the trickery here, and I'll put a stamp on this story. Came to pass in the time of her travail, verse 27, when she's going to give birth, that behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she is in labor, obviously, the one twin put out his hand. Now, it's very important because whoever is first born, you see, just like heir and raising seed to him and all of that, this is going to be the next generation of that. Very important. So the one twin puts out his hand, and so the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread. The moment the hand comes out, you know, you want to designate, this is the firstborn. And so she said, this one came out first. But then it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came on and said, how hast thou broken forth, or broken the breaches upon you, and named him Pharez? In other words, he supplanted his brother's position. Does that sound familiar? And then afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread, and his brother's name was Zerah. Now, obviously, it's Pharez that will be the child of promise. But again, that little thing going on there, as if to say, let's just make sure that everybody from now on knows all of the deceit and all of the unrighteous mess that surrounded this generation in the ancestry of Christ, and that's one that Matthew chooses to put out there for all Jews. Let's just remind all you Jews that the first woman mentioned is Tamar. Now the stories go on, and we know that, and several generations come to pass, and finally we get to the book of Joshua, and now they've wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and they're ready, you know, to enter into the land of Canaan, and I know you know this story. And so as they get there, Joshua, again, like he had been one of the spies many years before, about 38 years before, he decides to send a couple of spies into the city of Jericho. And Jericho would be probably the biggest, most fortified city of the 31 that are taken. If you can take Jericho, you can take the whole land, obviously. So he sends a couple of spies in there. And when the spies get to the area, the people of Jericho have heard about the Jews. They know of the Jews. Maybe they know a whole lot about the Jews, but they know of them. And I'm not going to get off into this tangent, but you may find some of this interesting to go and look up online and start doing some reading about Jericho's relationship with Egypt and their possible knowledge here. You might find it really helps you with this whole story. But anyway, the spies go in, and there is this time not someone who's playing a harlot, but who is a Canaanite harlot, and her name is Rahab. And as the story unfolds here, and I'm not going to read down through all these verses, but you can read it. And it talks about how, the fact that she lived with her father, and she lived literally, apparently, in the wall. And years ago, I was looking up and reading about this, and yeah, they would literally build, they would be like a double wall, and there wasn't Jericho. And using the two walls of the city, and in between, they sectioned it off. And, you know, some of the poorer people or some of the people like Rahab, if you're trying to get some business when it comes into the city, she's going to live right there. Well, she does. And she hides out these spies and, you know, for all appearance, it looks like she lies, you know, to the officials when they come in question and all of that. So you got Rahab. And who is Rahab? She's a harlot. She's probably a liar. She's a traitor to her own people. I mean, we could say all of that and be fair and be right. But apparently, she also has a side to her that she chooses at least God or God's people for whatever reason. And there have been a lot of suggestions about, you know, maybe she's really righteous and maybe she's really not. She's just doing this because she figures that the Jews are going to win here. Who knows? I don't know. But that's Rahab. She is a harlot. She does all these things. And in this story, she's the second woman. Now, how many women have existed, perhaps, between Tamar, that fourth generation, and go all these years later, 400 years of captivity and all of that kind of thing, get all the way down to entering the land of Canaan, you haven't mentioned a single woman between Tamar, and now you get to another harlot, or at least a real one this time, and you say, that's the second woman we're putting in the genealogy of Jesus. That's interesting to me. Don't know how many women live, how many righteous women live, but we get to Rahab, and she's chosen. Joshua, Judges, look through the time of the Judges. In that time, sometime, we go to the book of Ruth. And we know what happens here. Let's talk briefly about it. I don't want to get off on talking about Ruth, but we'll talk briefly about it. If we look at all of this with the story of Ruth, chances are great here is what happens. There's maybe a famine. And maybe the family that Ruth marries into, because she's not a Jew, but the family she marries into decides that they're going to just leave home, abandon the land, or at least leave it behind that they've gained as an inheritance from God. They're not going to stay there. They're not going to do really what they probably should be doing, and that's living in the land, praying to God for relief and so forth, and trusting in God. So it looks like, and you can disagree with this if you want, but it looks like they bail on the land and bail on what they're supposed to be doing, and they go for greener pasture in Moab, of all places. What is Moab? Well, I'm not going to take time to go back there, but if you went back to Genesis 19, remember that Lot and Lot's wife and two daughters came out of the city of Sodom. That's all that was spared. Mom looks back, sees the city, and turns into a pillar of salt. It leaves only Lot and his two daughters. Some have suggested that it looked like the whole world was being destroyed, and that Lot's daughters believe they are the only three people left in the world. I don't know. One thing that I do know is oldest daughter decides, what we got to do is get Dad drunk, and we're going to get him drunk tonight, and I'm going to lay with him, and I'm going to have a child. And then she does get pregnant, and so she says to her sister, that worked out pretty good, so we get him drunk again, and you lay with him. And the two descendants were the progenitors of Ammon, Ben-Ami, of course, the one, Ammon and Moab. And Ruth, if you're looking at it in Ruth chapter 1, she is a descendant of Moab. Now, this doesn't say anything about Ruth's character. We might talk about Rahab as a harlot and Tamar as playing the harlot, but it doesn't say anything about Ruth's character. In fact, if I were to look at Ruth's character, I'd say it's stellar, you know, personally. I mean, you're not going to find many people better than this. But to the Jew, and that's what we're getting at, to the Jewish mind, and to many people and their way of thinking. Listen, we're not that far removed from a time, and some of us older can well remember in our lifetimes, when if you were of mixed race or half-breed or all of this kind of mess, it really meant something. Ruth is that. She's a descendant of an incestuous relationship. Everyone knows Moab. Everyone knows Ammon. The Jews don't look at Ammon and Moab as cousins, and they are. I mean, think about it. Lot is Abraham's nephew. And so these are related people, closely related people. They don't look at it like that. They look at the Moabites and the Ammonites, they are idolaters, but far more to the Jew, they are descendants of an incestuous relationship. And they carried that stigma all the way to the time of Jesus. So here we are. We've had a woman playing a harlot, and we've had a harlot, and now we come to the third woman we're going to mention, and the third woman we're going to mention is the descendant of an incestuous relationship. Interesting. And then we're going to get to, and not too many generations later, we're going to get to the relationship of David. Now, David was a great man, and obviously so great that if you notice again in Matthew 1, you're talking about the descendants of Abraham, considered by the Jews the greatest of all, and David, considered by the Jews to be next. But yet David, of all his wives and all his children that he had, etc., etc., the one that we talk about, the one that we single out, and the one that God singles out to bring Jesus through is Bathsheba. But not only that. Of all the women we might mention, with these three already having been mentioned, we're going to get to the fourth woman that's mentioned from the Old Testament, and she is going to be someone that commits adultery with David. And whether she does it by choice or she does it by force, and we don't know that. He was the king, remember. But to the Jewish way of thinking, she is an adulteress, and she is the one who had been, and you notice even in Matthew 1, that's the way it describes Bathsheba. That is the description of Bathsheba. The one that had been the wife of Uriah. And everybody knows the story. David saw her bathing, took her. She got the child by David. He had her husband killed. Effectively killed him himself, and then he marries her. The child comes, if you're looking at 2 Samuel 11 and 12, because this is where the story is, you know the story, I'm sure, very well. The child comes, and God says, child's got to die. And he mourns and begs, but the child dies. And then she conceives again and has the child, Solomon. Now, just again, think about it. You've had, of all the women in the history of the Jews, and about 2,000 years of history, you're going to single out four. Tamar, that played the harp. Rahab, who was a harp. Ruth, who was a descendant of an incestuous relationship. And Bathsheba, who, in an adulterous relationship, at least, led to the murder of her husband. And finally, she is the mother of the ancestry of Christ. Of all women to choose, it fascinates me. There is no answer to it. Nowhere do I know, and certainly not in the Bible, but not outside the Bible, did anybody ever say, you know, I asked the Apostle Paul one time, why these women? There is nothing like that. But God chooses to do that. And if that's not enough, I want you to go back with me to Matthew 1. Because when you're looking at this genealogy, I would suppose, and I've said this often, you have to wonder if when God looks down into the world and says, time for Jesus to be born, and looks over the world, maybe just over the Jewish people, he chooses Mary. Mary is described as being a righteous young woman. You've got to wonder how good this woman was to be chosen to be the mother of the Son of God. However, what did the Jews think about it? I guess you go home and read a passage that I'm going to emphasize, so I'm not going to, in fact, I'm going to look at part of it next Sunday morning, so I'm not going to do it tonight. Go home and read John 8. Start about verse 29, 30, and read through the end of the chapter. And you can see how the Jews feel about Mary. Because they charge Jesus often, and I'll quote one line from the passage, we're not born of fornication, which insinuates you are. To the Jew, they don't believe that Mary is the miraculous, you know, that Jesus was born of a miracle. They certainly don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that she is a fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14, that a virgin is going to conceive and have a child. They don't believe that. Most people today don't believe that. There are many people who claim to believe in Jesus who don't even believe that. And yet Mary is with child, but to the Jew. Of all women to include, you're going to come down to your last woman that's going to be in the genealogy of Jesus is one that for all appearances, and I stress that, please don't leave here misquoting me on this one. For all appearances to the Jew, it looks as though he's birthed by fornication. Five women chosen, and that's the pedigree. Like I say, it fascinates me. I thought about this almost from the beginning for 40 years. And I've asked myself, what's the reason? Because that, to me, is even more interesting. Why do it? Why choose these women to emphasize? Why only these women to emphasize? Why do that? What's the reason? And I wonder. So from here on, it's going to be just me throwing some things out for you to think about. Take it with a grain of salt. You may not agree with any of these reasons. But these are some that I wonder if this is the answer to. Why Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba? Mary and all of these circumstances surrounding her. Is it to show that God can use us? No matter who we are, no matter where we came from, no matter what our background was, what our family was, or anything else, God can use you. As if to say to the world, I can use a woman that played a prostitute by a man who didn't even fulfill the promise, and that's what led to it. I can use a woman who was a prostitute that hid two people and maybe lied about it, chose to go against her people and choose the side of God's people. I can use a woman who was a descendant of an incestuous relationship, and when you look at her, it smacks in the face of everything you would think. Man, start off life like that, you figure you don't have a chance. Kind of like I quoted to you a few weeks back, and I said, what was said to me and my brother and sister, you kids don't have a chance. Well, yeah, you do. It doesn't matter where you come from. God has made be saying, I can use you no matter where you came from. No matter who your parents or your ancestors were, I can use you. Maybe it's Bathsheba when you look at her. And maybe she was raped, as some suggest. Or maybe she chose. It doesn't matter. I can use this horrible circumstance of the woman and her husband being killed and all of that. I can use a poor peasant girl, just choose her, and not make a glorious announcement. So, we might think, and I've heard people even suggest something like this, if you're going to put this on poor Mary, why not have the angels break open heaven and say, people, lest there be any doubt, I choose Mary. He doesn't do that. Is it to say where you come from, who you are, the color of your skin, who your parents were, how much money you have, or anything else? Doesn't matter one bit. I can use anybody that wants to come to me and be part of my people. Is it that he brought Jesus to the world in this way so we would understand we can bring Jesus to the world? No matter what we've done. Because after all, when you look at the four, you start emphasizing sin in every story. You have to, even in the story of Mary, though she didn't even commit any sin. You can be charged with a sin so long that in the minds of people, you're just synonymous with that sin, whether you did it or not. Is it to say that I can bring Jesus to the world through you, no matter what you've done or what people think you've done? Is it that God is saying, I can build a legacy out of your life regardless of how your life began? I go back and I look at a Rahab. We don't know how that story went, but I tell you this. She did convert to Judaism. I can never hear a bad thing about her again. Some man loved her enough to say, doesn't matter you were a harlot. I take you for my wife, and life starts over right here, right now. You look at Ruth. Even her own mother-in-law was ready to leave her behind in the land of idolatry because it was going to be so hard for her. What faith she had. The very famous thing that's quoted at weddings, no, your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. What an amazing story. And can God say to us, if you're willing to take that walk of faith, if you're willing to step out there like a Ruth, I can make you a great person. I can make of you a great person. Doesn't matter what you've done. Doesn't matter where you came from. Is it that God is saying to us, I can fulfill what I promised? I want to read two passages from the Old Testament, and I'll close with this. I'm reminded, turn with me to Isaiah 61. Reminded that when Jesus began what we call his public ministry, that he walked into Nazareth, his hometown, we would say, and he went into the synagogue to worship like he should have done. And he called for a passage to read, and the passage that he called for to read was from Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings. I want you to listen to this language. Good tidings to the meek, the humble, your translation says. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted. It's like when your heart is broken in pieces, God can mend it back together. To proclaim liberty or freedom to the captives. You can be in captivity in all kinds of ways. To sin or anything else. The opening of the prison to them that are bound. And to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Now he goes on in this passage. That's the part Jesus read, sat down and said, this is fulfilled today in your ears. But I go on and I read this and I love verse 4. Because a lot of people waste their life. And sometimes people take sort of checkpoints in their life. And I've known some of these. Maybe you have too. Where at a certain point, maybe in their 20s, they said, you know what, I've wasted my youth. Or their 30s, they come back and say, man, I've been wasting my life. Maybe that same person comes back in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, and never ever changes. But Jesus came so that a person who would recognize their life is wasted. What they've done in the past is a waste. Maybe just like these people. Maybe like a Rahab. We don't know her. We don't know what she did or how she thought or anything else. But I wonder about someone like her that would look at what she did and think about the waste of doing what she was doing in Jericho and be on her knees every day thanking God for the fact that life changed so dramatically, so drastically for her. To build, verse 4, the old waste. One other passage that I love so much. I want you to go with me to the last book and the last page in the Old Testament. And that's the book of Malachi. In a passage that I absolutely love this passage. Chapter 4 and verse 2 especially. Now this is talking about, we know from chapter 3, we know this is talking about the day of Jesus. We know this is talking about John the Baptist preaching and all of that. Look, chapter 3, verse 1, I send my messenger, etc. Then it talks about, I believe, Jesus here. And I want you to notice in verse 2 of chapter 4. But unto you that fear my name, the Bible says, shall the Son, and that's S-U-N, Son of Righteousness arise. I believe that's Jesus. We sing a song or two that calls him that. Shall the Son of Righteousness arise, notice this, with healing in his wings. I love that phrase. And I'm going to tell you what I think about it. Again, you can go home and think about this interpretation, but this is what I think about. I think about Jesus standing before Jerusalem, crying over the city. I think about Jesus saying, how often, meaning he's thought about this many times, what he would have done. How often I would have gathered you, like a hen, under my wing. How often I would have gathered you in. I would have protected you. I would have taken care of you. I would have loved you like a mother hen. And I think about this passage. You see, for the people who fear the Lord, the people who love God, Jesus does gather those people in. When you're with Christ, you're sheltered under that wing, in the shadow of his wings, you know, so many times used. But I love this prayer, the healing that is there. You know, when you've been alone, when you've been abandoned, when you've been a person who hasn't had anything, and you don't think anyone loves you. Nobody loves me. Nobody cares enough to do anything for me. When you've been that person and all of a sudden now you are safely gathered into a shelter where you know security. Oh, that's a feeling that you can't describe. That's what it is to be with Jesus. I wonder why these women, maybe we would be inclined to say, of all the women, why these women? Because, man, that's what Jesus is all about. If you're here today and you're not a Christian, if you would come to the healing of the wings of the Son of God, if you believe in him and you'll confess he is the Son of God, if you'll repent, be willing to change your life like, I believe, a Rahab would have done, if you'll be baptized, your sins will be washed away. You'll be secure with Jesus. If you're here tonight and you've been baptized and you've wandered away from him, let him shelter you again. Let him take you there and give you healing. Won't you please come while standing?
We are the promises.